What views or opinions do you hold that are different from your father?
Please welcome Jordan Peterson.
Here's Jordan Peterson.
Today's guest is Mr. Jordan Peterson.
Hey, Joe.
Hello, Jordan.
Usually, Dad and I don't disagree on the ideas. Normally, we have relative alignment on that, but I feel like often we disagree on motivation. I think that I have a greater tendency to not assume ill will on the part of the person with the idea. I think I have more trust overall.
Why do you choose to be more private than the rest of your family? Like, Mom has a podcast now. Dad's obviously Dad. I've been doing my thing for a number of years. Why did you decide to stay more private?
Yeah, well, I think there's a bunch of reasons, I suppose.
Welcome to my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So, how's it going? How's life? How's life in Toronto? Still in Canada?
Life is very busy. Very busy, and Canada's not that different.
I thought it got different, but I was also very averse to the cold for a very long time. So
yeah, it's still cold, but it's not as different as it was 3 years ago before you left.
So you think Toronto's recovered a bit?
Oh yeah, it's recovered. I mean, there's still problems from the pandemic that have lasted, but nothing that's particularly significant. Like, I would say the city's still thriving, and overall the downtown is a little weird now and a little more dangerous.
Okay, have you been down Sherbourne recently?
Oh god.
That was terrifying. I went down, that was like U.S. ghetto. Oh, yeah. That was the worst I think I've seen. I haven't been to the scary parts in LA, but that was crazy.
It's always been a rough area, but it's probably 20 times worse than it was in 2019. Like, because I used to go there to go to the gym all the time. I'd, like, go to Sherbourne and Queen, and it was always sketchy. Like, someone would, you know,
yeah,
come out of the woodwork.
Yeah, would come up to you and
like, do something weird, or,
yeah,
you know, be taking drugs, or, you know, pull down their pants, or whatever, yeah, it was going to be. But now it's, like, you can't look anywhere, and something like that isn't, like,
yeah,
that's happening everywhere you look. It's quite concerning. So, but that's by far, I mean, not to like, but that's by far the worst area.
Well, that's good.
The downtown has a different feel. And I'm sure it's mostly related to the fact that probably there's way less people working down there.
Oh,
right?
People
and
are
so
still
it's
remote?
Probably that, at least hybrid. And so I would say there's probably 50%, maybe 40% less people there day to day. And just that, you know, you
maybe
need a really vibrant downtown.
That might have been what I was picking up on in the summer. I just was like, this is off. I'm not
sure. Yeah, it's just a little quieter. And as soon as a downtown is quiet, they get sketchy.
Terrifying.
Like, they get sketchy. And so, I mean, that, I don't know what the solution to that is, because I don't think hybrid work policies are going anywhere very soon. But I don't know. It's a tough one to solve.
Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying this episode. Again, we're exposed to so many toxins daily. I don't think people take that as seriously as they should. I wish this was touched on more, because I think it's what's behind my autoimmunity and food sensitivities and my parents' illnesses, environmental exposures. And saunas are one of the things you can do to help your body detox faster, among other things. These sauna blankets work just like a big sauna, but they're portable, easy to clean, easy to store. They ship worldwide. And if it doesn't meet your expectations for some reason, or maybe you're just whiny and you don't want to sweat, their easy return policies has you covered with a 30-day trial and a solid 12-month warranty. You can go to bondcharge.com, that's bondcharge.com/MP, and use code MP to save 15% off. It's linked in the comments, so consider it. Enjoy the rest of this episode. Well, I asked my audience a bunch of questions,
mm-hmm,
so we're going to run through some of them.
Cool.
But, and so maybe I'll just start with one, and then I have some questions of my own.
Sounds good.
The main one is, why do you choose to be more private than the rest of your family? Like, Mom has a podcast now. Dad's obviously Dad. I've been doing my thing for a number of years. So why did you decide to, well, stay more private?
Yeah, well, I think it's like a bunch of reasons, I suppose. And I don't even think it was exactly a decision that I made, but
yeah, it's probably more of a decision to not do that.
Yeah. And so, like, it's partly my personality to a certain extent. I think I've always been a somewhat private person compared to all three of the rest of you. And so I liked to keep things kind of close to the chest, and I like to have my circle, and I think that's part of it, is just a personality thing. I think part of it is that when I decided, I guess, to marry my wife, it was 2016, and she moved into our house in October 2016, which was like there were reporters lying down the street. And so I think that as kind of, I mean, it wasn't the beginning because we've been together for 5 years already by that point, but it was kind of soon after we'd made the decision that we were actually going to like get married or at least have a life together. And like that being the first thing that happened kind of after that is kind of like, do we want this in our life? Like, is this actually something? Because when you enter the public, like, I don't know, conversation, I suppose, and that sort of thing can happen. For sure. Like at some point you're probably going to run into a situation where you say something and then the reporters are at your doorstep.
Yeah.
And you know, our goals as a family are they're really family goals. Like we want to have like a good solid unit that has, you know, that's protected from the world where we can, you know, educate our children and sell our values and have fun and not have to have the pressure of the outside world on that. And so more of a family decision in that area. And then the third reason, I suppose, is that, you know, it's not like I don't have interest in I do have some interest in a public life, mm-hmm. but it's always been very, very specific, my interest in that. For instance, my company essay, I'm interested in promoting that publicly. To a certain extent, although I would say I'm more interested in the technical side of it. And so I tend to do that instead. But I am interested overall in promoting. I'm certainly interested in its success. And so there's that. And then I've always been interested in pursuing my music publicly to a certain extent, although I also have some things holding me back from doing that. I always have a little bit, personality-wise or whatever it is. But I've been able to overcome those certainly over the last few years and start to put more music out and Yay. Start to do that. So I think that's it, is that I if I'm going to be public, I want it to be specifically in the domains that I want to be public in. And I also want to, I want that to be strategic.
Yeah. Do you think if 2016 hadn't been like such a nightmare for us that maybe you would have kind of embraced the opportunity for being public more? Because it was basically just stressful, really stressful.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. It's hard to say. Like I had plans to go to Berklee music in Valencia and do like a performance art master's degree. And I was going to do that, and I just didn't end up doing it. I don't know. Like, I didn't really even make a decision not to do it. I ended up making different decisions to do different things.
Was that 2016?
No. I mean, I was thinking about it then. But no, that was like 2018 that I was going to do that.
So things were still a mess.
Things were still pretty weird. Yeah. but it's not that I've never had interest in that sort of, like, being public, or at least in some manner. But yeah, it was always related to music or my work in some specific way.
So no reality TV show?
No.
that's not for you.
No. I don't even like watching them. It makes me uncomfortable.
Oh, they make me uncomfortable too. I was feeling, I think it was last year when I got really sick from mold, and I was just like, I need some, like, what do people do? I need to do something that isn't work, and I can't think very well. And I tried to watch Real Housewives of Miami.
Yeah.
Oof.
I've never watched that, but
it's worse than you would think.
Yeah. I did watch a season of The Bachelorette though.
Oh, you did?
That was actually really enjoyable. But I've only watched one, but I watched it in 2020 with two of our good friends. We just like did that every week and watched The Bachelorette when we weren't seeing anyone else.
A social event.
It was a social event because it was Toronto and they were the only people we were seeing and we had a baby. And so it was exactly the right vibe of like media to be taking in.
Not too stressful. The stress is really not.
You could
real
make
stress.
Fun of them. It had nothing to do with any of the weirdness in the world. So yeah. But overall, I haven't watched reality TV since. But
yeah, I feel that. Okay, so we should talk about Essay. How's Essay doing?
Essay's doing really well. Yeah, we've We launched a year and a half ago. For people who don't know, Essay is an online writing platform. It's designed to help people structure and edit their writing, primarily without the use or help of AI or large language models. Currently, it's based on our dad's work. He wrote a document like 20 years ago that kind of outlined an editing and writing strategy. It was just a really long Word document, and you had to work through it kind of like a manual in order to implement the strategy of writing and to learn from it. And so I decided 5 years ago or so that it could be implemented through software in a much more straightforward way, easier to use, better experience, and hopefully a much more scalable technology than that. And so we launched about a year and a half ago and have had about 200,000 people sign up and use it.
Oh, wow.
And we have a free trial. So most of those people are free users, but we've gained a huge amount of knowledge from obviously having that many people use it and write on it, and have completely rebuilt the software over the last year. And so it's much more stable now. We're starting to introduce much more complicated new features as a result of that, like kind of background work in the software. And so that's really exciting. And we're also starting to use it in classroom settings, which is our big goal of this year, I would say.
Yeah, well, that I can see blowing up, because basically, then tell me if I get any of this wrong, but you can go into the app and it helps you figure out how to write something, and it tracks how you write it. So I think where this could be really big is implemented in classrooms, and you give teachers access to the back end, and then they can see. And in order to copy AI, you'd have to spend so much time rewriting it kind of haphazardly and reorganize, like you wouldn't really be able to fake it. So if classrooms need a tool to monitor people cheating from AI, it would be huge there, and it helps you learn how to write.
Yeah, so it's got some real benefit there, because a lot of the anti-AI tools that you see out there are basically AIs that detect other AIs. And I think that I'm not a teacher, but I think it would be depressing to be so distrustful of your students that you're running. I mean, I'm sure teachers kind of feel just not great about using even anti-plagiarism stuff by using a software platform and then, you know, convicting their students of plagiarism through the software. I think it's much more valuable for a teacher to see the process. And the great thing about the way we've built the software and are still developing it is that we're trying to really get a comprehensive understanding and eventually a comprehensive report to deliver to a teacher of the way that the student was thinking while they were writing, and the way that they, you know, continued, the way they edited and everything that kind of led towards the final product. And so that means that students can both be trusted that they did the work, because there'll be proof of work through the process, and also students can be rewarded for that process instead of just the outcome. Because, you know, part of the reason that people are so attracted to the AI writing platforms, other than the fact that they're super powerful and interesting and, you know, and easy. So, you know, it's got all that going for it. But also, people are almost always just marked on the outcome. And that's what those things do. Mm. They just produce an outcome that's polished and, you know, maybe it isn't your idea, but it's someone's or like, you know,
something's
idea. and so if a teacher has the opportunity to more easily grade the process, then it'll take away a lot of the upside of using an AI for the student. And so that's something we're really trying to get right in the software. And we've had a good start in that right now. And so that, I think that could be really big. And the other thing we're going to do this year is release a mobile app for the software,
great.
Which is going to be a big deal for us, obviously, because almost 95% of our marketing is done on mobile and we don't have an app. So it's it's definitely,
that'll be huge.
It gets in the way of our signups. And we've also figured out a way to make it interesting on the phone, because the reason we didn't do it initially was that we still don't really believe that people do a lot of long form writing on their phones. I mean, people do, obviously, and certainly people in third world countries do, because that's all they have.
Oh, true.
And so certainly it's a market, and maybe it's a huge market, but it's not an ideal hardware for writing as far as I'm concerned. But the way that we've built it means that it's much more segmented, the pieces that you're working on. And so you can iterate on one sentence on your phone, which is a lot more. It makes a lot more sense for writing on a phone in that way. So it took us a while to figure out exactly how to do it and to make it a reasonable, like, I don't necessarily want to call it an improvement to the software, but a good direction for the software in a smaller screen. So we're really excited about that, and hopefully it'll grow the our user base as well, and let us put more resources into the development of the platform.
Do you have an ETA on when that's going to be out?
I mean, I've pretty much built it. It's just not polished yet, but like within like a month and a half from now.
Wow.
So like mid-February or March.
Okay.
Yeah, so soon. Yeah, it's built. It's just not like bug tested and polished.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And we'll link all of this in the description. So if anybody wants to check these out, they'll just be linked in the description. Okay, ready for another question?
Yep.
Okay. What views or opinions do you hold that are different from your father? What about your sister? You can start with dad. Does anything pop up to mind? This is like postpartum brain.
Pop up to mind. Did your mind birth anything? Right,
right. Oh, no, don't even say that word.
No, you know, I don't think that there's usually dad and I don't disagree like on the ideas. That like normally we have relative alignment on that, but I feel like often we disagree on motivation. And so one of the things that I find when we're having discussions about ideas or political events or whatever it is, I think that I have a greater tendency to not assume ill will on the part of the person with the idea. And so I think I have more trust overall.
So like what kind of idea?
Let me see if I can think of an example.
Like ideologies?
Yeah, like ideologies. Let's say young people who have gone to university and ended up with this kind of idea set that's oppressor oppressed and framing the world in that way. Like I did a university degree in postmodern philosophy. And so I know a lot of people who think that way. And I also understand where those thoughts come from. And I mean, certainly dad does too. But I think that you can blame the people for sure, but it's really been a difficult situation for a lot of undergraduate students to go into school expecting to be educated and coming out only having read, literary theory and postmodern theory and everything that's breaking ideas down into oppressor oppressed, into like deconstruction, like deconstructing the ideas into whatever the professor or the writer intended you to come out thinking. So I think that I have a lot of sympathy for for people who have been, it's not exactly indoctrination, but who just have been brought up with this kind of mindset.
I feel like it is pretty much indoctrination.
And it's just a weird version of it.
Well, yeah. It's an insidious and a sneaky.
It is, yeah.
But I mean, I think that's also why he goes after universities so hard.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
I feel like that's fair.
It definitely is fair. The universities have done a poor job of that for a very long time now.
Yeah.
And certainly that's where a lot of these problems are coming from. And you can see that in the news right now with all the Ivy League schools losing their presidents.
Yeah, good riddance, though, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll see what happens next.
Yeah.
The same person in a different form comes in or not. I feel like you had a really, I feel like your university experience was fairly positive, though, at King's. Mine was atrocious.
Yeah, well, King's is a great school. I went to the University of King's College in Halifax, and it's a liberal arts college. And the first year program there is, I think, a really, really good example of what undergraduate students should do. Especially in their first year, they go through the history of the ideas that undermine our culture, or undermine, that's the wrong word.
underlie,
yeah. So
that was a good Freudian slip. Dad's gonna bug you about
that.
Yeah,
no way.
Yeah.
But anyway, they go through kind of the Western corpus, and then they get students to write essays every 2 weeks about an idea within one of the texts that have been read, and there's a lecture every morning, and it's everyone is part of exactly the same curriculum. And so it's a really, there's a lot of camaraderie. People are writing essays at the same time. There's a lot of motivation to do the work and to think about it deeply. And so that's the first year. And it's extremely effective way of introducing high school students into kind of a higher education setting. Because it's really, really hard for a 17, 18 year old student to go into university and, you know, go to six different courses, you know, at every different corner of a large campus and, you know, be motivated socially, which you need to be. You need to be motivated socially when you're a teenager. That's like the source of your motivation. And so this is the sort of cohort, I suppose, based approach for education, I think is extremely effective, especially for young people. If I went back now, I don't think that would matter nearly as much. But certainly as a 17-year-old, it made a huge difference to my motivation.
Yeah, and, I should have done that type of thing. But I hated Halifax so much. I wanted to be in Montreal. It's like Montreal's where the party's at. I'm going to go there. I also wanted to do psychology, and I didn't realize how much of a disaster that was going to be at Concordia.
Yeah, yeah. Halifax is a great university town. It was, I can't really think of a better place to go to university than Halifax, or at least before. I don't know what it's like now. You know, times have changed a little bit, but it was great. You know, there's six universities there. It's like half students. You know, there's a great strip of bars downtown that, like, so you just always know where to go. There's no decision making to be done, which is really nice when you're, you know, young and dumb.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wouldn't trade those years. That was a great place to be for me. And the school itself was really good. A lot of good professors and a huge opportunity to learn to write and to be mentored by really smart people about your writing and about your thinking. And so it was... Yeah, I was really pleased with education I got there.
You know, yeah. I didn't have one professor that I liked.
Yeah, that
in
really
4 years.
That's really unfortunate.
That's pretty rough, huh?
That is. That's
like all of them
terrible.
Were like, this is
yeah.
really not good.
Yeah, well, it is hard to build a relationship with a professor in most large universities. It's difficult, especially as an undergrad. There's so many of you. And professors are very busy and it's hard to even know how to do that.
Yeah, and Concordia.
Especially if you don't want to do it with any of the professors. Like, if
I mean,
that was
part
you
of
in that
it.
Way.
But Concordia also was just like the education wasn't good, and it was weird back then. Like it was. It's an art school, so it was pretty tilted towards. It was mostly like feminism, like really third wave, intense feminism.
Yeah.
Back then, and
yeah,
that
we
was
had
like
that
in my
King's
classics
too.
Courses. Right. I did Homer through a feminist lens. That was
right.
How they taught it. That wasn't the teacher I liked. And then it was, okay, we're going to learn Homer through a feminist lens. And I was like,
yeah, yeah. Well, that's
what
I mean from what I was talking about earlier about how like just everything has turned into like a deconstructionist view. Like it's literary theory. It's something like you can read Homer, but like you're going to read it in, you know, through this lens of gender or race or whatever the lens is.
Homer.
It completely undermines the history and the moment, right? You're supposed to read texts in the context that they were designed to be written, and you're trying to connect with the writer, right? Like it's a bizarre understanding of how to read. That whole
kind of a narcissistic
lens. Yeah,
way
absolutely
of looking
it
at it. Like
right?
We're going to do it through this lens
yeah,
that
I
find
decide.
Relevant
yeah.
right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. I don't like it.
Yeah, it's not ideal. What about me? I'm less like vocal about things than Dad.
Yeah, yeah, you are. Where do we disagree? I mean, I think I'm just more polite than you.
Well, that's definitely true.
And so I think most of the time when we disagree, at least it's the, you know, about things that you've said publicly, it's more about the way that you've said it than what you're saying.
Okay, I can get behind that.
And I think that's just primarily a result that I guess I'm just more polite. In the way that I frame things often, but I can't think of a specific example at the moment.
Excellent. If you guys ever consume alcohol, ever, it should probably be vodka, but that's not what I'm talking about right now. Please try my supplement. I drink probably once a month, other than pregnancy and breastfeeding and things, which puts a total kibosh in drinking. I don't drink that much. But this supplement eliminates the hangover. If you want the scientific research, although I was told that people aren't interested in scientific research, but I figured you guys would be, you can go to fullerhealth.com and read the studies. That's what convinced me that the compound we used in this actually worked, because a hangover supplement sounds like it wouldn't work, but this actually works. People in Japan have been using it for thousands of years, and like the white man just doesn't know. I hope YouTube doesn't suppress me for that. Anyway, we managed to purify it and put a high dose in a pill. So you get like half a year's worth of this with one order if you don't drink very often. It helps save your brain from the toxic effects of alcohol. And if you like it, please leave a review. I love reading the reviews. But honestly, I just want people to be healthier, and drinking isn't healthy, but I don't know. Sometimes letting loose can be good for you. And why not alleviate the negative impacts with this magical supplement? You guys know I don't push supplements because most of them are a complete waste of money. You just pee them out. This one isn't. It has no fillers or extra ingredients, and we have a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you're safe. You could even try it and then complain and get your money back, even if it works. Don't do that, though, please. But give it a shot. Fullerhealth.com, code MP15 for 15% off. Enjoy the rest of this episode. We have some funny stories from this. Did you guys fight when you were little or now? And I was recalling this to Mom the other day.
Oh, yeah.
So we would get into like little kid fights.
Yeah, for sure.
Obviously, because we're very close in age. And I remember this one time we were in the basement and I must have said something.
Did I throw a shoe at you or something?
No, you threw this little porcelain bear.
Oh.
Do you remember this?
I remember throwing something at you.
Okay, you threw it and it hit me in the head. And it's this little porcelain bear, which is like, that's a rock. And he did have a good arm. It whipped it and it hit me in the head. And I remember going, that didn't hurt. And then going into my room and crying.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Nice.
Nice.
I mean, not necessarily. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't know what you said, but I'm sure it was snippy enough that it deserved a bear hurled at you for.
But I wouldn't say we fight now.
No,
we just had like normal kids.
We also didn't fight a whole lot as kids. Like,
no.
We had a very good relationship as kids. We always had, because we were so close in age and only one grade apart, our friend groups were always overlapped a lot.
Yeah, so we played a lot together.
And so we mostly just played together, and you know, we got into fights like any siblings do, but there was a pretty good trust between us, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in high school we went to party all the
time.
Yeah,
I was gonna
get
bring
these
that
people out of my house.
I was like, should we delve into that? I was a grade above, and I used to want to have parties, and they weren't crazy like police coming parties. They were 12, 13 people. Were they bigger than that?
Yeah, they were probably like 20 people.
What?
Not huge, though.
Okay, anyway, not huge. And we were in the basement, so like parents couldn't hear. And I wanted to have a party every weekend.
Yeah.
Like basically as much as I could and have people over. And I do all the cleaning. And Julian would be like, absolutely not. And I'd invite them anyway. I'd be like, I'm going to clean up everything.
Invite all my friends.
And my friends too. Oh, and it got worse because I had to take a fifth year of university.
Yeah.
Because I had my hip and ankle replaced in grade 11. And I missed 6 months of grade 11 and 6 months of grade 12, which basically screwed up 2 years of high school. So I needed to get high school credits. And then in the fifth year, there were some fifth years, which was kind of normal in our art school because a lot of people took a fifth year to do more art courses. But then my friend group
was
latched onto your friend group because everyone was a year younger than me.
In retrospect, it was quite fun. But in the moment, I remember like going upstairs and steaming and being like, oh my God, she's done today.
But then you partied.
Oh, of course I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked to party. I just didn't like the party being designed behind my back.
Is it difficult having family that are so vehemently disagreed with by people online? Has that affected your friend group at all?
A little bit, but not too much. I mean, I think the reality is that everybody who says anything online is disagreed with. And so I don't really see that as evidence of anything except for publicity, essentially. And being public in the, you know, discussion of current events and philosophy and all of that, right? There's going to be disagreement, and that's okay. And that's part of the game. It has made, I think it sometimes changes the way you talk to people. It does. I mean, the reality is that, like, I do know some people who don't like things that are said by either you or my dad or whoever it is. And so there's definitely been moments, and we've had some moments with people who weren't like good friends, but just were acquaintances, where you could tell it was just getting in the way of the relationship. Which was unfortunate, because like I try to collect friends who I can talk to openly. But I also have a lot of old friends. And so the reality is that, you know, a lot of these people are connected to me prior to any of this publicity. It's different. It creates a different dynamic sometimes, but it hasn't been a true problem. And I think that mostly both my friends and I have done a good job of keeping the lines of communication open and keeping the relationship up to date and the trust there.
That's good.
Yeah. So no, I don't find it difficult, other than the obvious difficulty of when things are said, it actually, you know, everyone knows about it, or at least a lot of people know about it, or it's in the news, and there's more stress there. Of course there is. Although I try not to read it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've gotten better at that over the years, is just getting used to what to pay attention to and what not to pay attention to, in terms of the publicity that's accrued through whatever it is.
Like almost ignore everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not pretty much. Everything, but almost everything.
Yeah. When I find, like, if I start reading too much, I just delete the apps.
Yeah.
I probably do that once every 4 or 5 months. When I get too addicted, I just delete them.
Like X?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Instagram.
Instagram too?
Yeah, I just delete all of them. I deleted Reddit permanently because it just
Reddit is.
I used to like Reddit quite a bit, and then over the last three years.
Reddit hates me too. Reddit hates me. I went on there one time. I was like, oh my gosh, this is what they think?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, Reddit is kind of, and it's gotten worse. Like I would say like 4 or 5 years ago, it was a pretty vibrant intellectual community on there, and not really a too much like of one particular opinion, but it's gotten a lot worse. And I think that's partly just because a lot of people have stopped using it. And so when the group of people shrinks, it, you know, often it creates an echo chamber. So I don't really use that one anymore. And yeah, I like to delete the other ones if I find myself too enthralled with them.
That's probably a good rule for everybody.
Yeah, it's a good one. I'm also using like a screen time app right now called Opal that...
I think I just downloaded that.
Yeah,
did you get an ad for it on Instagram?
Probably. Uh-huh. Instagram ads? My God, they're good.
Like, yeah, they are good.
Like, I don't think I've ever been...
I actually appreciate Instagram ads.
Instagram ads are really good.
I do need that. Thank you for listening.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. They get me way more than any other ads.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it, but they probably listen to everything you say.
Yeah, arguments, everything. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But useful. It's like, it takes a little bit of searching off my plate.
Yeah, so I downloaded that one, and that's been good, because it just kind of allows you to... I mean, it just takes advantage of the built-in screen time stuff in iOS, but it's kind of a nice interface and makes it more difficult to bypass the screen block, because you try to open an app and it's like, actually, you have to wait 20 seconds. But I wanted it now.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe I'll turn that on. That's not too annoying.
You can also change that a little bit, but the 20 seconds is pretty good. That's like enough time.
Be like, I shouldn't be on
Instagram.
If
you're kind of a person that's a little bit, you know, you're like, oh, 20 seconds, I could do like quite a bit of stuff in that 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Then it's enough that you just shut it off.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, we could do this one. How have you dealt with your dad's sudden rise to fame?
I mean, I think pretty well overall. It's been very weird, and it continues to be very weird. Obviously in 2016, we were mostly just trying to keep up and stay above the water. And so that was interesting. I was living with mom and dad at the time. And so I was very, I guess, involved with that period of time. And then, I don't know, we had family trouble for like the next 3 years, 4 years. And so that...
Five?
I don't know, a long time. five. So that obviously was more concerning than any of the public life stuff that you know, took a backseat. And then, you know, I try to keep boundaries, so that my priorities stay consistent and so that I'm true to what I want my priorities to be, while also, you know, trying to take advantage of the opportunities that come around and the relationships, that, you know, through who dad knows and that sort of thing, and just kind of try to take the positive elements of it. And I think I've done a reasonably good job of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. But it changed everything, really. It did. And there's no denying that. And it continues to be a very strange change because we grew up with not a huge amount of money and certainly with no publicity. And so, you know, it all happened after we were adults. And so it's definitely a weird thing to adjust to have your dad just suddenly, everyone's dad.
Yeah. That even, having money is weird.
Yeah.
That's weird. Yeah. Not that I'm complaining about that at all, but.
No, but it just, obviously it changes things. And so you do have to adjust, and it's adjusting as an adult to a different set of circumstances it's difficult, and it's hard to do it, with grace. I'd say like it is, it takes a lot of work.
Why do you think you were better at, boundaries? Like, I know ever since you were little, you know, sometimes people would come over and ask you to do something and you'd say no. And I remember being little too, being like, why does Julian say no to everything? It's really annoying that, like, his go-to pretty much was no. And my go-to to a fault was yes. And I didn't really learn what I wanted versus what other people wanted me to do until I was 27. Right. Like, it took me a long time to be like, am I doing this because I want to do it, or am I doing it because I feel guilty? And doing it because you feel guilty isn't
a good reason to do it.
yeah. It's like a toxic reason to do things.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be doing things because you feel guilty. That's not good for anyone. It's not nice of you.
No.
It's just bad.
No, it's just going to create trouble in the future.
Yeah, and it doesn't make, it's not virtuous at all.
No.
Just because you're nice to people because you feel bad.
Yeah.
It is not virtuous. And it took me a really long time to, like, get to the place where I was doing things because I wanted to do them for other people, not because I was feeling guilty. And I just didn't know the difference. And I don't know if that was partly because I was on antidepressants for so long and I just wasn't in tune with how I felt. Right. I think that was a big part of it. But I feel like do you think it was a difference in how we were raised, or was it just like life circumstances for both of us, or personality, or what?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can see it with my two kids. Certainly, you know, well, both of them like to say no. So, I think it seems like it was at least partially temperamental. I'm fairly disagreeable, and I do know, I think I've always had a pretty good sense of my priorities, and I've never been particularly concerned with saying no and the effect that that'll have.
Did you feel guilt?
Socially?
Like guilty about saying no, or did you just not
really? Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I felt guilty. I'd say that it makes me uncomfortable, but not nearly as uncomfortable as saying yes to something. And I think partly, actually, I probably as a kid, I was playing with saying no to see what would happen, to see if I could get away with saying no to things. And then, you know, you couldn't always get away with saying no. And so then I started saying yes and lying about it. and certainly that worked worse. Right. That was a less effective strategy. Well, also because, like, I don't think I had enough guilt to motivate me to follow through on the yes when I said it out of guilt.
Oh, true. That's so a problem. Like,
I was like, I don't want to say no because it makes me feel bad. So I'm going to say yes, but I also am not going to do it. And that, like, either gets you into way more trouble than just saying no. And so I think there was probably a little bit of just trial and error there. And I realized that, you know, given who I am, the easier path and the better path was just to, you know, just to be honest and, you know, say no when I want to say no. And it, you know, it's not that, it isn't an ideal strategy. You know, it still gets me into trouble. Like, it, you know, like with Jill, my wife, it's like, Yeah, it is hard to ask me to do things. And like, I get that that's annoying.
I see where you're coming from. Like, it's still a no, like, but.
But like, yeah, I understand that like maybe it'd be nice if I said, if I wanted to do the thing that you're asking me to do.
That's funny.
You know, that's a work in progress. I think that as a disagreeable person, you want to train yourself to reframe other people's questions so that they intrinsically motivate you. And that, I think that's really helpful, because it's like, I think that, you know, I'm quite disagreeable. I'm quite open. And so I'm interested in doing things. And when someone suggests an idea, it's not like I'm not interested in the idea. I just often have a different priority and I'm like, no. But like, I think that taking a moment and trying to frame the question and prioritize it from your own perspective is a helpful thing as a disagreeable person to try to do that.
That's a good tip for disagreeable people.
I think so, yeah.
Find out what motivates you and what people are asking you to do. Think it could benefit your relationship, even if you don't want to.
Right, yeah. figure out how it can fit in with your priority structure, because it usually can, right? Like if someone asks you to clean the kitchen when you're, I don't know, texting. It's like, sure, the text is important. But, you know, you can understand why the kitchen
cleaning
should
the kitchen
be cleaned.
Is annoying, but yeah. The wife is also angry.
Right, exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of truth to that old saying about, you know, the happiness of one's wife. So, yeah, so, you know, as you get more socialized, as you get older, hopefully, then you start to learn strategies to overcome your personality.
Yeah. Well, so speaking of family, why did you decide to start a family so young? Because like, how old were you when you first had a kid? Well, how old were you when you got married?
26, got married.
Which is like reasonable, but it's young now.
25.
Yeah, okay.
I was about to turn 26. And had kids at 27. I mean, I think that the reason was, there was a bunch of reasons. The first one was that I chose a partner who wanted kids intentionally. I was always attracted to women who wanted kids. And so my girlfriends always told me that they wanted kids. Even in high school, it was like, when we talk about the future, it was like, yeah, they want kids. And that was like, I thought that was a good thing.
Seems reasonable.
And with my wife, she always wanted kids. And we talked about it. And we also talked about when a good time to have kids is. And we also talked about how I probably would never think it was the right time to have kids. And dad also, and mom, both of our parents were really good at kind of understanding and explaining that sort of when what having kids is to your life and when the right moment is. And also that it's somewhat of an act of faith, right? And so you don't know when the right time to have kids is. You don't even know the first or last thing about what your kid's going to be like. Kids are extremely complicated, and it's an adventure. And so basically we decided that it would be good to have that adventure when we were young for like a whole bunch of reasons, right? Like, first of all, you have good energy when you're young. It makes a lot of sense to have kids when you're young. Historically, that's when people have kids. You're more biologically ready to have kids, especially if you're a woman when you're young. And also then when you get old,
you're free.
No. Well, yeah. I mean, like we won't be very old when our kids are 18. And so, you know, that's a pretty big benefit. You know, in all likelihood, if we live, an average amount of time, we'll meet our grandkids and meet them when they are like grow up. And I mean, that's a big deal. People don't think about that. People don't think 50 years into the future when they're 18 very often, because how can you, right? Like, there's a lot to think about in the now. But especially when you get into your late 20s and early 30s, like, it's time to start thinking about 50 years in the future, because it's very easy to think, oh, you know, it's not the right time now. I don't have enough money. My career isn't exactly where I want it to be. If you have a partner who you can see a future with and you guys can align on the fact that you want kids eventually, it's like the right time is probably now. It probably is, just because you're young and then you have the opportunity, and you may not have the opportunity in 5 years and then you don't have kids. And having kids is like, is a very it's quite the adventure to have kids, really. It is.
I don't think you experience, this is going to make people mad too, unless you have kids and then you'll understand. But I don't think you can experience the amount of love you have for one of your kids in any other way.
Yeah,
like you can absolutely get a puppy, and puppies are amazing. I would have a dog if I wasn't allergic to everything on the planet. But the amount of love you have for one of your own kids, it's like...
Yeah, it's an overwhelming amount of
it's
love,
crazy.
And it's very different.
It's unbelievable, actually. It's crazy that you can experience that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it makes you think about the future in an entirely different way, right? It connects you to future generations in a way that you cannot be connected to future generations otherwise. And so that's really important. It's really important in all sorts of ways, but certainly it's important politically, right? Your political perspectives change when you have children because your priorities change, right? And so you're thinking, you have to think further down the road, and you have to think about, you know, in the future when your kids are, you know, at least 20 years down the road at minimum. And so that changes the way you think politically, and it changes the way you think philosophically. And yeah, it's been very interesting. And doing that young, I don't think I did like ridiculously young. I didn't like younger than most people are doing it. Certainly most people who live in cities are doing it. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. Financial reasons come into play often. And you know, we were lucky that that's not, that wasn't one of the things that was in our way. But no matter your financial situation, I think that taking kids is always kind of a, you have to take a risk, and you have to, and that's just part of the game.
Yeah. I do. I talk to one of my friends about the timeline too of having kids, because it takes, like, it eats up all your time when they're little.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as a mom, it's crazy, especially the first year. Like, I forgot how long breastfeeding takes.
Yeah.
It's like, and then I looked it up. I was like, how long? Oh, it's a full-time job. That's how many hours it takes. It's 1,800 hours on average a year.
Well, especially when they're so little, they just do it all the time.
Yeah. So I was talking to one of my friends who's kind of had one kid after the other, and she's like, this is a lot. And I was like, yeah, but it's really, because I have a six-year-old now, so it's really the first number of years that are a lot, and then it gets easier and easier. And then if you do look 18 years, 20 years away, it's like, okay, we're going to be like mid-40s. I'll be probably like around that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get your kind of alone time with your spouse again for years after that, but you also have family now.
Yeah, well, I've seen graphs that show the amount of time that people spend with certain relationships over the course of their life. And
they're
the
sad
amount of time that you spend with your kids is a pretty short window in your life overall. And the amount of time that you spend alone goes dramatically up as you get older. And so trying to reduce that curve somewhat is a pretty good idea, because the reality is that as you get old, your friends die, or you do, or some people start to go disappear in a variety of ways, either because they die or just
and
because your situation changes or whatever it is. But like, you know, having kids really does solidify a community. You have a community then. And if you treat them well and, you know, maintain a good relationship with your kids and their kids, then boom, you have a community all the way until you die. And that's, maybe there's not a more important thing than that. Probably not. Certainly. Yeah. I can't think of a more important thing. Yeah. So that's why,
I agree.
That's why we did it. And it's very hard. We're so busy. It's outrageous. Like it's outrageous how busy you are when you have little kids. Like you can't even really imagine how busy you are. You're always, there's always something that's necessary for you to do. And so that's interesting too, because you understand that your ability to be busy is way bigger than you thought it was. It's like, I thought I was busy before, and I was, but now I'm like 10 times more busy. And I still think, well, if I could do this amount of busy, I could probably do like more busy than this, because you know, your capacity just expands. And your ability to delegate expands and that sort of thing, just by necessity, right? Those things that happen by necessity often, if you're lucky anyway.
That was a great answer.
Thank you.
Which parent, do you each feel you're more similar to? You go first.
Yeah, well, I mean, I look more like mom. Yeah, and I think that probably personality-wise, we have more overlap, although not entirely. Like, I think that
she's way blunter than you.
Yeah, way blunter, for sure. We shouldn't say more about that because
there.
No, but yeah, we have our differences. I'm quite extroverted. Mom isn't as extroverted as me, although when when she's not with Dad, she's very extroverted.
Dad overshadows that. You know, I thought she was introverted for a really long time.
Yeah,
you?
Yeah.
Like,
I thought she was more introverted
one.
Than she was, than she is. And yeah. She certainly isn't particularly introverted. Like,
not so, really at all, I don't think.
No, no. So probably I have more personality overlap with Mom. But also when, like last time we did a podcast together, there were like a bunch of comments. They were like, you explain ideas. Your sentence structure is just like your dad's. So,
oh, cool.
So that was cool because I didn't That's really take compliment. That in. And then I listened to it. I was like, oh, yeah, I can see kind of a little overlap there. And the way I structure sentences is similar, although I do put more periods in my sentences than Dad.
So do I.
Yeah, I don't end every
Most
sentence with
do.
So, comma. I remember in 2017, we were running the Jordan Peterson Clips channel on YouTube, and Jill, my wife, was in charge of clipping Dad's lectures into like 3 minutes.
Yeah, good luck.
That's a hard job.
Yeah, it is.
Because there's no periods.
I tried to give that away too, and no, like people couldn't clip, and I was like, this isn't that hard, but it's hard.
Yeah, hard enough. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm personality-wise more like my dad, but I definitely have aspects of my mom as well.
Yeah.
Like I've got her bluntness, which I don't know if it came out because I had such a problem with boundaries for so long. And then when I was 27, I was like, oh, boundaries are amazing. Okay. And then just reverted to mom. And it was like, too far. Too far. You went too far. But so I definitely have that from mom. But I think I've got the... And they have an overlap in personalities too. Like they're both
plenty.
Very open and things. So it's hard to see where that comes from.
Yeah. 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 I don't know where the openness came from, but it certainly came from both sides.
Yes. Just attacked from both angles.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. What was it like growing up with a sister that suffered so much? Was my suffering that obvious, though? I mean, for a... Oh.
Well, it depends when. I mean, yeah, it was obvious. Well, I think that when you grow up and experience a tragedy of one sort or another, and you know, lots of people experience tragedy when they're kids, there's all sorts of ways that it can affect you, and it certainly affects you quite a bit. I think that, you know, it affected me. It just made me grow up faster. I think that's really what it was. And you know, I had to take on a different sort of responsibility, and didn't have to, I suppose, but I did take on a different sort of responsibility when I was young than probably I would have otherwise needed to or been in the situation to. But also, Aww. We took care of each other when we were kids. Like, I think that that was something that was instilled in us from the beginning, probably, was that, you know, that we belonged to each other as siblings. And, you know, it wasn't just our parents' job to take care of us. It was also our job to care about each other and mm-hmm. to take care mm-hmm. of us and to prioritize our relationship with each other and to not treat each other as, you know, means to an end or whatever it was, and, you know, and to treat each other well as, and I think that we both did a good job of that. Obviously, when you were very sick, I had to take on more of that. But at the same time, like, you were always very defensive of me if anyone was out of line. So I didn't feel like I didn't feel like it was one-sided during that period. But what it does is it just, first of all, it gives you perspective as a young person, and you know, perspective of the potential tragedy of life is really useful as a young person if you're well supported. And I was well supported. We had, you know, a strong family and a good extended family, and we were stable in most ways. And so the fact that we had tragedy in our life and so close, and yes, a very, like, I'd say a very visible one, right? I mean, you were injured most of the time because of your illness. And so that was very obvious. I had to like help you up the subway stairs and stuff.
Oh man, that sucked. That sucked.
And so, yeah, it was obvious, but it gives you perspective. And that's very useful as you, certainly as you A lot of people in university do not have very good perspective about about the tragedy of life and where to prioritize your concerns. And I think that being in a situation like that helps with that. It certainly does. And I know lots of people who have experienced tragedy in their childhood, and often they have better perspective.
Yeah. Crazy, huh?
It makes sense.
I've totally forgot about the subway. I remember.
That's good.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, just delete that year. I remember the one year, this was when I eventually stopped going to school.
Yeah.
I remember I went to school, and this is when I needed my hip replaced, and my hip locked. I stepped out of the subway and my hip locked, yeah, and that was like bone on bone, and it locked. And I like stood there and was like, this is bad. And I checked my phone to like call for help, and my phone had no service.
Yeah.
And I like hopped over to the wall and sat down,
yeah,
and just like cried. That was a horrible period of time.
Yeah, that was rough. And that wasn't the only time that happened to you where, I mean, maybe not usually by yourself, but.
I think I was with a friend who went and got one of our friends who helped me up the stairs. But I don't remember very many. I remember leaning on you when I was walking.
Yeah.
For like a long time. Jesus, I'm glad that's over.
Yeah.
That was rough. Ugh. Okay, we're going to go on to the next question. Crazy. Life is crazy. Are you still disagreeable as you are when you were two?
No.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, no. No, definitely not.
Is anyone as disagreeable as a disagreeable 2-year-old still, really, and no, like has not any friends or life?
We have a disagreeable almost 2-year-old.
And does he say no all the time? She says no all the time.
Yeah, she's the one.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, our son is disagreeable enough as it is, but he's also sensitive. She's not sensitive. Our daughter is not sensitive. She's like, she's pulling all the strings, you know?
Wow.
She's like, so that's fun. It's fun now. It'll probably be fun. I think it'll be very fun. I think it's going to serve her very well.
Yeah, me too.
In her life, right? Being disagreeable, if you can also be socialized, is a very, I think it's a personality trait that can serve people very well, because it allows them to prioritize their own priorities, which is what.
And
everyone actually wants.
Not be resentful,
right, people,
too.
Everyone wants that. Not just disagreeable people. Like, people who are high and agreeable also have priorities. They just tend to prioritize other people's priorities for the sake of the social connection.
Yeah.
And that also has its benefit. But, yeah. No, I'm not. And I think that I've done a pretty good job of socializing my disagreeableness.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
You don't, like, you come off as totally reasonable. You don't come off as a disagreeable person.
Thank you.
Except on the rare occasion when it's like, no. You're like, well, why did he say no to that? But whatever.
He said no, and then he smiled, and I'm really thrown off by that.
Yeah.
I think that's how I did it. It's like,
no in a really friendly way.
Yeah,
no!
Yeah. Be really friendly with you now. Yeah. That's like, that's just a disagreeable person. Not 101, but like 400 level class.
Yeah.
The disagreeableness is where, like, you still say no, but you do it in a way that makes it seem like you agreed with the person and they're happier afterwards.
That's funny. Okay. Okay. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, I know you guys have this idea for a cafe in Toronto.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what is the plan there? And whereabouts is that going to be located so people can visit? And what's the time frame?
So we're trying to... We have this building in the beaches in Toronto. It's on Kingston Road in Toronto. And Jill, my wife, has always had a dream of opening a cafe. She's worked in cafes many times and helped open a pottery studio cafe in Halifax when we were in school there. And we now have this office building on Kingston Road, where the front half of it we're planning to turn into a cafe, and kind of the dream for it is to kind of turn it into a community hub sort of place. And that's sort of the idea around it. It's going to be called the Paper Route Cafe, which kind of connects it peripherally to SA, but also Paper Route is a community event. It connects the community through transfer information. And so that's kind of the idea behind the name. And we're going to have really good coffee. And we have a French pastry. I don't think she's actually a pastry chef, but she is from France and enjoys baking. And I think that's a good combination of things. And so she's helping us design our pastry menu. And we're going to have a place for music. We're going to have a place for little kids to play in the back.
Oh, nice. That'll be so good for the beaches.
Yeah, it's really good. And where it is, there really isn't anything else within about a 15-minute walk. And a large number of families live close by. And so I think it'll be a good spot to go for mothers with their kids or for people who are working or just whoever. And so we're really excited about that. And it'll also kind of cement us into that community in a way that we'd like to be.
That's so super cute.
Yeah.
You're not going to call it Peterson Cafe and just wait for eggs to be thrown at it all the time? You went a different route.
Went a different route. Yeah.
Paper route. Aha.
Yeah, exactly. Subliminal. It still starts with a P.
It's in there.
Yeah. So we're excited about that. And we're involved with the design of it right now and figuring out what coffee equipment to have and all that. So it's very interesting. And Jill's really excited about it. And so that's been a fun project.
That's cool. So do you think that's end of this year?
We're planning to open in April or May.
Whoa,
so it's
really?
It's soon. We're trying to fast track it.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
But there's not a huge amount of renovation work to do. So it's really, I think it's a pretty reasonable timeline. We want to open in the spring.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
I have this dream for future me of opening. This is not the same thing, but I want a speakeasy, 20s style.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to dress up a certain way to get in. Otherwise, the bouncer is just going to be like, no, riff raff. Right. And then they serve really good steak. And then at night, it opens onto a dance floor. And there's going to be cabaret dancers and
nice
people singing, whatever goes in that speakeasy. I have a playlist that's
singing 20s jazz.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
But that's later.
Yeah, that's later. Hopefully not something that happens as a result of societal intervention.
Yeah. Although, who knows how wildly successful.
When the cows
successful.
Become illegal, then the steakhouses will become speakeasies.
Oh, true. Yeah. Oh, no. Although, how much money could we make then? Not that I'm... not that I want no meat for everyone.
Yeah, promotes an agenda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Veganism, it's the way.
Yeah. Yeah, that was when my friends grew weed in Halifax. They wanted it to remain illegal
so
that their activities could remain profitable.
Totally understandable. Okay, Julian, that was very fun.
Yeah, that was lots of fun. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure.